The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is May 5th, Thursday, 2011. The first order of business is Senator Michelle's, Senate File 76. Welcome to the committee, Senator Michelle. Senator Michelle, is this the first time this year you've been before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Senator Limmer, members, Chair Limmer, how do you want me to answer that?
Just honestly.
It's yes. Yes.
Members.
we're ready.
Okay.
Act accordingly.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Well, thank you, members, and thank you particularly, Chairman Limmer, for giving us a few minutes on Senate File 76. With me is Emily Pugh, my legislative staffer. I just wanted to make that clear. I'm going to tell a story of a particular family who's been through some experiences, which was really the impetus for this bill. But I didn't want you to think that my legislative staffer was part of that family. They are not here, and they are trying to protect some confidentiality and anonymity, as you'll understand as we go through this. So, and Mr. Chair, if I can also ask at the outset here, we do have an amendment. I know Mr. Backus and others have been a part of the, I believe it's the A2, and so that would be my preference for.
Members, I think that's in your packets, and for the record, we do have a quorum. Please proceed, Senator Michelle. This would be an author's amendment.
So, members, let me. Thank you again, Chairman Limmer.
And Senator Michelle, would you like to move your author's amendment?
Please.
Senator Newman offers the A2 amendment on behalf of the chief author as a author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Thank you, Chair Limmer. And thank you also, Senator Limmer, for taking some time with this particular family earlier in the session. They also sat down last year with Senator Moi at the time. So this has really been a two-year saga for this family. So let me just tell you the story and then explain why I think the bill makes some sense. And it's an awful story, members. I know the Judiciary Committee hears many tales. So I don't want to suggest this is the worst you'll ever hear, but it's not fun. Members, this family has two young daughters, elementary school age, and they had developed a friendship. The family developed a friendship with their neighbors, as we all hopefully do, and literally their next door neighbors. And a young man who lived next door became kind of a routine babysitter for these two young girls. And so it was a trusted relationship, and the two families and the parents all got along. Well, it later came to be known that this trusted young man in a babysitter role had criminal sexual conduct with the older of the two daughters multiple times while the younger daughter was also in the room. So this went through. This was caught. And Mr. Chair and members, there are no there were no arguments about over facts. This was an action in Hennepin County, and ultimately, this offender, the next door neighbor, pled guilty to a second degree criminal sexual conduct. I want to make sure I'm accurate here, Mr. Chair. Yeah, admitted guilt to the charge of criminal sexual conduct in the second degree. He was adjudicated delinquent, probation, letter of apology, 30 hours of community work. There was no EJJ status, which has some significance. The court ordered a no-contact order and some treatment. So let me... Now comes the public policy question that is before us. Again, this is their next-door neighbor, and the offender comes from a two-parent family in a suburb of Minneapolis, and his. Both girls, of course, both daughters are considered victims, although the actual act was only with the older one. And what this bill does is, in that kind of a setting, permits a judge to make sure that the next-door neighbor offender isn't living next door, so that the victims who are trying to heal, the young victims who are trying to heal from criminal sexual assault, can heal without looking literally across the yard at the offender. And I'm trying to be careful here, Mr. Chair, but I want you to know some of the things that this family experienced. So even though this offender has, again, he's pled guilty, there were no questions of fact, he shares a bus stop with these two young girls. Their properties adjoin. When he's out mowing the lawn, their mom feels like she's got to bring him inside. So that is when, starting last year, Mr. Chair and members, that this family wanted to make sure that this doesn't happen to somebody else, that judges clearly have the authority and the discretion and are allowed to take the residence of the offender in mind and even go as far as ordering some kind of separation or distance. So I appreciate, members, that this is, we always want to be careful not to legislate on one incident. And this may be an unusual one. I mean, we certainly hope it's extraordinary and unusual. But the daily reminder for this family, the visual reminder, they believe has made it hard for their daughters to recover and heal. And I think they also make an argument. I'm not a doctor, but they make a good point that how can this offender heal and rehabilitate when literally every time he steps outside his door or looks out the window, he sees the house where it happened and the victims that he assaulted. So, Mr. Chair, back then to the language that's in front of us, the A2 that you adopted, thank you, again makes it this permissive for the court to prohibit, I'm just going to read this portion of the amendment 1.8, prohibit the child from residing within 1,000 feet or three city blocks from the victim for a portion or the entire period that the court has jurisdiction over the child. So we want to give judges discretion here, but I think it's important that we put some kind of a signpost in state law that, you know, we articulate a lot of important rights and things that the court has to take into account on behalf of the offender, but that it's really important that victims and their families understand that this is an option, that literally where this offender resides is something that should be taken into account of. So, Mr. Chair, the language in front of you is actually some work that includes some help from the County Attorneys Association, who we've been meeting with to help scrub this over the last couple years. And so they, I know they're available if you have specific questions on this language. It reflects action in the House, where I know it met deadline last week. So maybe I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and I imagine there'll be some discussion and there may be some further things I can say.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Michelle, my question is, how did you come up with 1,000 feet or three city blocks? Why not a mile?
Senator Hall. Or Senator
Michelle.
And that might be, that might have been pulled from current. I'm getting a no from that. I don't know if Mr. Backus might have an answer on, why a specific number, of city blocks. My sense is that we were looking at some other statutes that referred to distance and separation, but.
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, in the drug laws, we have definitions of park zones, school zones, drug treatment facility zones, and usually it's a little different there. It's usually, I think, 300 feet or one city block. So I think it was just an attempt by the author to find something, that he was comfortable of and thought was reasonable. But we do have kind of that precedent in the drug laws.
Thank you. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Michelle, if you could look at page 3 of your bill at line 3.30, it indicates that item I, which is written findings as to why the best interests of the child are to be served by the disposition ordered. And then we go to subdivision 1A, and it says, if I'm reading this correctly, the court is not required to prepare written findings as to why the judge is making a determination that the juvenile offender cannot reside within 1,000 feet or three city blocks. I think I'm reading that right, but can you tell me why that's in there? Why would we not ask the court to make written findings?
Senator Michelle.
Senator Newman, some really smart people have reminded me that if there'd be a fiscal cost to that if they had to put that in the findings. That was at least an educated guess. And we did not want to create, we want to give an option to a judge in this kind of a case, authority, permissive language, but not a mandate and not cost.
Senator Newman, I'm going to see if counsel has any advice on the cost factor.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have any knowledge of the cost issues, but I know in the, this is the juvenile delinquency proceeding disposition section, and it usually these dispositions, given it's juvenile justice, is often geared to the rehabilitation of the offender. And I think there was some concern in drafting as to whether this particular disposition would necessarily survive that test because it's, it was more geared towards the victim as opposed to the offender. So that provision was being put in there just so that requirement that it be in the best interest of the child didn't get in the way, so to speak, of the judge imposing this as a disposition.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Michelle, just for as you proceed forward with the bill, what we really have are two children that are involved in this. And if I understand the juvenile proceedings correctly, the real intent of juvenile proceedings is to rehabilitate. And so I am just questioning, why we would require a court to make written findings for one of the children but not the other, even though one is a victim and one is an offender. The other thing that I would request, Mr. Chair, if I might, is could we have Mr. Backus just give us a real quick rundown on the amendment where we are listing, it appears to me we are listing criminal sexual conduct from the first to the fifth degrees that would apply to this restriction. And, you know, it's not crystal clear in my mind as to what the differences would be. If you could do that, Mr. Backus, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, yes, the amendment, among other things, broadens the bill. The original bill applies to juveniles adjudicated delinquents for first and second degree crim sex. This expands it to third, fourth, felony fifth degree, and criminal sexual predatory conduct. So the intent there is to apply it to any felony criminal sexual conduct offense. And, you know, it's a really broad number of offenses it could potentially apply to, but basically it's any felony crim sex.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Backus, when I'm looking at crim sex conduct in the fifth degree, that's sexual conduct, intentional touching of clothing covering the immediate area of buttocks, etc. There's no sexual penetration. There's no sexual conduct underneath the clothing. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, yes, you're correct, although it's only the Subdivision 3 felony that this would apply to. And that the felony provision is essentially a repeat conduct under the fifth degree, and it's a particularly egregious type of fifth degree, but it does not involve penetration or any kind of real contact, I guess.
One final question, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your indulging me. Mr. Backus, does not the court already have the discretionary authority to do what this bill is purporting to do?
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, I don't know if I can really answer that question directly. I mean, the court has a great deal of authority, obviously, when fashioning a juvenile disposition. Certainly the court doesn't have this explicit power, which is what's being put here. But, you know, the court, when adjudicating a child delinquent, has a host of options, including out-of-home placements, presumably various types of protective orders, but there's nothing explicit similar to this in law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Michelle, did you have any other comment?
Well, and I appreciate Senator Newman's line of questions, and he and I had a chance to have a little hallway conversation, too. You know, I think there are a lot of examples in state law where we highlight some more suggestive language. Again, I think it's important that the victims and their families know of this. It may reside in some way within the discretionary powers of the court already, but it's hard to understand. You just asked a really smart person if he could be really explicit about that answer, and he couldn't. And so I would almost look at this as a belt and suspenders. Let's make sure. Let's make sure.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. Is there similar language for adult criminal sexual conduct that they have to live somebody so far away from their victims?
Senator Goodwin, I would guess there's somebody in here who could answer that. I'm not aware of.
Perhaps counsel can help us.
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear the specific question, but I think it had to do with whether there's a similar provision for adults.
Yeah. Right.
No, there's no explicit provision for adults either. This legislature hasn't really legislated very much in that area. There's a provision relating to level three offenders, which is kind of the worst sex offenders, who are being released, who are still under correctional custody, where the correctional agent may try to reduce how close they are to other level three offenders or schools. That's the closest thing we have, but it's not really that much. It's similar, but not quite on point.
Just to that,
Senator Michelle,
Chair Limmer, and just I don't mean to interrupt your line of questioning, Senator Goodwin, but it did remind me of one of the frustrations of the mother in this case, which was, if I hate to use these hypotheticals, but if an adult had done this, you wouldn't be worried about him living next door because he'd be in jail, he'd be in prison. But the fact that it was a juvenile he got to live next door to the victim.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Would that be true at all levels? Maybe Mr. Backus could answer that. Would that be true at all levels of criminal sexual conduct, that it would automatically mean jail or prison?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Backus. Senator Goodwin. Not necessarily. It's generally the judges have a great deal of discretion, both at the adult level and the juvenile level, especially at the juvenile level, in terms of what the sentence would be. You know, it would be based on the specific offense, what the sentencing guidelines would say, and then what the judge would choose to do based on that for adults.
Okay. So I'm just asking Mr. Chair that question because I think that would be important too. I mean, if an adult had the same kind of contact with a child, and then they didn't serve a prison term or whatever. The other question I have is I noticed that there's the effective date is last year. You know, that I've seen that done very, very rarely, but in this case, would this mean that then anybody that committed it apparently does mean that anybody that committed a crime like this would immediately, once this becomes effective, could be brought back to court, and the judge could then say, you know, this person has to move, or how do you see it playing out?
Senator Goodwin, if I could bring your attention to the A2 amendment, we changed the effective date to reflect this year. A2 amendment.
Never mind.
Senator Michelle already anticipated.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Senator right. Goodwin. I appreciate the desire to maybe have some retroactivity here, but that was not intended last year nor this year.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Harrington?
Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, I just had a question on your fiscal note. Assuming that a child 15 is adjudicated delinquent, does some JDC time or some Red Wing time and has come back out and is still under court supervision, where is the financing going to be? Because I assume he's then going to have to be placed. He's too young to live on their own, so they're going to have to get placed in shelter or in some other care. Is there any provision for that in terms of the fiscal note?
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to get confused with our terminology, but there is not a fiscal note with this bill, or if there is, you're looking at something that I'd like to look at.
Well, is there a fiscal note? I guess maybe that should be my question.
No.
So,
yeah. We do have in your packet, Senator Harrington, there is a fiscal note.
Okay, yes, I thought I did see one, so.
Well,
and it doesn't show any cost.
Show
it shows no cost, actually, so. Is the county going to have to pick up the cost for sheltering the child, or what did you envision in that situation?
Perhaps Senator or Mr. Turner could help with your question, Senator Harrington. We'll let him get back to his chair.
Mr. Chairman, members, sorry, Senator Michelle, the request for a fiscal note took place about 2 months ago. So anyway, the fiscal note went out to the Supreme Court Sentencing Guidelines Corrections and the Guardian Ad Litem Board. None of them claimed any fiscal impact. However, your question was not addressed in the note about who would pick up the costs if the child had to could not live at home. That isn't addressed by the note. The court said there'd be no impact because this is just part of adjudicating a child and it's permissive, et cetera. And of course, there wouldn't be any additional cost if the child was sent to, say, Totem Town or an out of home placement. But the question of when he comes back is not addressed by the note.
And.
Senator Michelle.
At least partially to Senator Harrington's question, in this particular incident, for a time, the offender actually just lived across town with his grandparents. So, you know, obviously that's not always going to be the right thing to do or an option for some, but in this case, that actually would have been rather easy.
Any other questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Michelle, I'm just looking at the various degrees of criminal sexual conduct statutes, and they talk about if the complainant is under 13 years of age, if the complainant is 13 to 16, if the complainant is 16 but under 18, in other words, various ages of the victim.
Yep.
Your bill talks about the perpetrator, the juvenile, being 15 years of age. In your mind, any difference in terms of the application of your bill if the victim is 13 or 15 or 17?
Not in my mind, Senator Newman. I would note that in none of those scenarios could you consent, right? 13, 15, 17. Now, this is where I think we want the court and the judge to apply the facts as he or she sees fit. It's going to be different. And maybe that would be a significant difference when the judge makes a final determination.
Senator Michelle, I think the age of consent in Minnesota is 16. And so a 17-year-old...
Mr. Chair, when my 17-year-old daughter... I will not allow her to consent to anything until she's out of the house.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Whoa. Then there.
You have to dig a moat.
At least you're on record.
Senator.
I hope she's not watching.
I'd like to bring a little more definition, Mr. Backus, on the age of victim.
Mr. Chair, members, the bill doesn't really address the age of the victim. It could be a minor victim, or it could be a 25-year-old victim. There's
okay,
there's no limitation there. But generally, yes, the age of consent is 16 in Minnesota, except for a certain type of offenses where you can't consent if you're 17 or 16, if you have a certain relationship. But generally speaking, it's a 16-year-old age of consent.
Yeah. Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Senator Newman, would you move the bill? Or Senator Hall? Senator Hall, move Senate File
I would.
76 as amended. Be recommended to pass and move to the floor. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you very much, members. Appreciate it.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Next on the list, Senator Harrington. Harrington, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, I do believe this is my first time actually sitting here.
That was my question.
So I'll just open it up now. So I thought seriously about wearing a vest today, but believe that my colleagues would protect me, and I hope that I'm proven right.
Well, we prefer you without the vest.
Oh, well, thank you very much, sir.
Let's not go there.
You don't want to know. So,
Senator Harrington, please proceed.
I'd like to move Senate file number 515.
I think it's House File 361 today.
We have a Senate file number and a House file number, so.
Okay. We're going to go with House File 361.
That will work for me. All right. This bill modifies the crime of fleeing a police officer or a peace officer in a motor vehicle where death or bodily injury results from the attempt to flee. The bill would extend the law to situations where a suspect initially flees the police in a motor vehicle but abandons the vehicle and continues to flee via other means. The proposal stems directly from a couple of different occurrences, but most poignantly the case of Officer Mike Bedard from the Minneapolis Park Police. Now, I can tell you from my experience as a cop that fleeing a police officer is a particularly dangerous activity. It's dangerous for the occupants of the car. It's dangerous for the cops who have to try and chase them down, and it's dangerous for the public who are endangered by the reckless disregard for life and safety by the people that are fleeing. The case that in point was on November 1st, 2007, when Minneapolis Park Police Officer Mark Bedard was killed. He was trying to apprehend two people involved in a drive-by shooting. They bailed out of the car, fled on foot, and Officer Bedard was killed after the men had bailed out of the vehicle. The courts and prosecutors ruled that since they were no longer fleeing in a motor vehicle, they could not be charged with causing his death. In addition to that particular case, I can tell you of a number of cases in St. Paul where the new tactic that we saw was that auto thieves would be driving the car. They would have the cop roll up behind them. We'd light the car up. They would slow, jump out of the car, but leave the car in gear. And the cop would then, as they were running up to try and apprehend the suspect, in many cases have the car rolling up right behind them, still in gear and still moving, or the cop would have to make the choice, do I try and jump in the car to, say, pedestrians and others who might be in the path of the car? And we've had officers dragged by those cars as they tried to jack it into park or try and get the emergency brake to operate. So it is a very dangerous situation in both cases. What this bill does is it holds people responsible for injuries they cause while they're fleeing in a motor vehicle, even if they bail out of the vehicle and continue fleeing on foot. It is limited to only those fleeings that begin in a motor vehicle. It would not impact folks who just start out fleeing on foot. There is a law for that. It's a misdemeanor fleeing on foot, and we are not interested in having that law changed at this time. The bill has no fiscal impact. We did do a fiscal note on that. The cases are fairly rare, but when they do happen, they happen with really very grave consequences for the officers who are chasing the car and for the pedestrians that might be in its path. In order for this to pass, in order for someone to be found guilty of this, the state would have to prove causation beyond a reasonable doubt. So this isn't just they were out of the car and they were now miles away and the cop gets hurt. There has to be a causal link between the fleeing and the injury to the officer. One of the key protections of the bill is that requirement the state prove the fleeing actually caused the death or injury beyond a reasonable doubt. And the courts have defined that causation as an act that is a substantial factor in causing the death or injury. I have three witnesses that like to testify in regards to this. The first is Mike Bedard, brother to the slain officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yep, Mike Bedard, B-E-D-A-R-D. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Bedard, and the proposed bill that I am here to testify about is the direct result of the death of my brother, Mark Bedard. Mark was the Minneapolis police officer killed in November of 2007. While on patrol, he responded to a drive-by shooting in North Minneapolis that led to a car chase. The suspects crashed and fled on foot. My brother chased the driver and was accidentally hit by a squad car responding to the scene to provide backup. He was rushed to North Memorial Hospital and spent the next 10 days fighting for his life. On November 7th, my brother died. He left behind a wife and a 3-year-old son. Mark spent 10 years protecting the citizens of Minneapolis and made the ultimate sacrifice. My family and I have spent the last 3 years dealing with his death and trying to put our lives back together. One of the most frustrating aspects surrounding Mark's death is the absolute failure of the criminal justice system. The people responsible for his death were not held accountable. After the suspects were arrested, my sister-in-law and I met with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. They informed us because Mark was killed as a result of injuries sustained during a foot chase, not a motor vehicle chase, they were not able to charge the suspects with a crime. In the state of Minnesota, it is only a misdemeanor to flee police on foot, regardless of the outcome. In the months following Mark's death, it became abundantly clear that something had to be done so this injustice would not be repeated. Minneapolis Park Police Sergeant Ann Dineen, a co-worker and close friend of Mark's, contacted the Hennepin County Attorney's Office regarding our desire to pass a law that would hold people accountable for fleeing police on foot. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman was gracious enough to allow Hennepin County Attorney David Brown to assist us in our efforts. Mr. Brown drafted a bill that would enhance the penalties for people that decide to flee police on foot. I realize there is nothing I can do to bring my brother back. However, the unfortunate reality is that at some point another person will be killed or seriously injured as a result of a suspect's decision to flee police on foot. At a minimum, we feel this law would help provide future families some sense of justice and hopefully help ease their pain. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bedard. Senator Harrington, your next testifier you want to introduce?
I'd like to have Sergeant Ann Dineen of the Minneapolis Park Police testify next.
Sergeant Dineen, thank you to, or welcome to the committee, I should say. Please state your name and and proceed with your testimony. Please pull the mic nice and close. The acoustics in here aren't all that great. Please proceed.
My name is Ann Dineen, and I'd like to say good afternoon, Mr. Chair and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I'm a patrol sergeant with the Minneapolis Park Police. On behalf of my department, Mark's friends and co-workers, and the citizens of Minneapolis, we are grateful for your time. I would like to especially thank Senator Harrington and co-authors for sponsoring this bill. On November 1, 2007, Officer Mark Bedard was fatally injured during a foot pursuit in Minneapolis. Mark was chasing suspects involved in two separate drive-by shootings in front of two different schools on that day. Mark collided with a squad car and died as a result of his injuries on November 9, 2007. The two offenders whose actions set into motion the events that led to Officer Bedard's death were charged with and pled to felony drive-by shooting. Their sentences were less than 4 years each. In fact, one party was already released last summer. He has already violated his parole and gone back to prison to finish 120 days. The second party is out of prison and currently in a halfway house. Because of their actions on November 1, 2007, Mark Bedard has been dead for over 3.5 years. Yeah. The current flee-on-foot statute does not address possibilities of serious harm or death to others if pursuit of a felonious criminal goes from vehicle to foot. This is a loophole that is easily remedied by this bill. It wasn't until 1997 that fleeing in a motor vehicle became a felony. Fleeing on foot became a misdemeanor in 2005. Our intention is not to make every foot chase a felony. Rather, we are asking that the state repair the gap between when the crime of fleeing starts in a motor vehicle and moves to a foot chase, holding those responsible accountable for their actions from start to finish when it directly causes harm. This correction is for all citizens of Minnesota and not just for Mark Bedard. However, Mark's death is what made us aware of the problem that existed when it came time to charge those responsible for his death. In Minneapolis last year, there were approximately 136 motor vehicle flees, 56 of which crashed and turned into foot chases. One crash had a 2-year-old in the car that suspects fled from. People flee for all sorts of reasons, and in pursuing these criminals, innocent citizens as well as law enforcement lives are in jeopardy. When a pursuit ends with the occupant still in the car, they can be charged for all the harm they have caused by their actions. If it ends after they bail from the vehicle and are captured on foot, the accountability is non-existent. And we are asking that you please consider this proposed legislation, and thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Sergeant. I believe, Senator Harrington, your next witness is Mr. Brown from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Mr. Brown, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairs and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you to the chair of the committee for hearing this bill, to Senator Harrington and our co-authors for agreeing to present it. Senator Harrington has already provided many of the points that I would have made, so I will simply thank you for considering this bill. It is an important piece of legislation. These are cases that are happening every day in our cities where the danger that happens in front of that fleeing vehicle and the danger that results from the pursuit that that it requires merits this reaction. We believe that we have narrowly tailored this bill to meet the harm that we identify. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to come to the table and testify in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, is there any questions from any members of the committee? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill, Senator Harrington. I have a question. Maybe it's for counsel, because there was a woman in my district that was killed, a young woman, because of a police chase that went all the way from Robbinsdale into Arden Hills, and she was killed. Her family has called me, and I've spoken to them about this issue, but I haven't yet checked it out. When is it appropriate for police to chase through residential neighborhoods, and is there any laws that that restrict that? Because but for the chase, this woman would still be alive, and I I don't know what the police procedures are normally on that, nor do I know whether or not we have laws on that, but it appears to me that oftentimes it is caused because of the chase, and certainly I understand we want these people to be apprehended, but when the chase is going through a residential neighborhood, I'm concerned about the times that does happen, that those kind of accidents do happen. Is there anything in law currently that talks about when it's appropriate or not appropriate to start a chase or to...
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I don't believe there's anything specific in law relating to that issue. I mean, there is, but not to the specifics as to when to engage in a chase. There's requirement that there's law enforcement training on police pursuits, and we put that into statute, I think it was like 10 years ago. And I could get you more details if you'd like, but there is a requirement for peace officer training on that, and I think it would include when to pursue a chase and when not to, perhaps.
Thank you. Good. Senator Harrington, maybe you can tell me what kind of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodman, that is a correct statement. As far as I know, there are no statutory limits on police pursuits. There is the requirement through the post boards, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, that each department send their officers through the training and that they have a policy regarding the training. And then every department sets its own policy in terms of what are the guidelines. So, that, for example, in my department, we looked at traffic conditions. We looked at pedestrian traffic. We looked at time of day. We looked at weather conditions. And then we gave certain individuals in the department, sergeants and the watch commander, the right to call off a chase if they felt that the conditions were too hazardous given the cause that originated the chase. Obviously, if you have a chase where someone has just been murdered and the suspect's in the car, we would pursue more aggressively in that case than we would if somebody was just speeding. So it does vary from department to department, and I'm not aware of any statutory language that provides any particular guidance other than the will of the department, which is directed typically by either the chief of police, the sheriff, or the director of public safety.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could comment to that as well, knowing the chief and now senator explained it exactly the way it is with policies and departments. But it's something that's been, as Mr. Backus explained, that's been something ongoing for years, this chase thing, this whether we should be chasing anybody. And it was big discussion some years back as to whether, and Senator Goodwin, you're right, if you don't chase somebody, chances are they're not going to get hurt. However, it's not a right to drive in Minnesota. It's a privilege to drive. And one of those privileges is, or at least it would seem to me, to somebody who has common sense, that when they see a red light or a siren, that they would react to that, they would pull over. If they don't pull over, then quite frankly, the flags fly up for the officers that are doing the chase. What are we running from? And Chief Harrington's homicide or drive-by thing, that's what we would call no-brainer work there. We're certainly going to chase that, but what is that person running from? And I think the state has done a good job of making the driver more responsible for those decisions. And they make a choice when they decide not to pull over for that squad car, and it could be and eventually end up into a fatal choice. That's why they've left us in law enforcement administration to be able to put policies together, because there are some, I know there are some policies where the supervisor might call the chase off because it's heading into a large populated area. But if it were to be somebody that were a suspect of a serious felony, you probably wouldn't see that happen. My question to if I could, to the County Attorney Brown, is this peace officer is very, very open, so it's every peace officer in the state of Minnesota. It also include conservation officers because they are licensed peace officers. Is that correct?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe that's true, although I would have to defer to counsel. I have not looked up that statutory definition, but I believe that's true.
Yeah.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, and I apologize for not knowing because I signed on to this bill as well. So I'd like to applaud Senator Harrington for carrying this forward, and certainly our hearts go out to those that have lost their lives in the line of duty. Just this last weekend, I was asked to be the keynote speaker at the Law Enforcement Memorial up in Detroit Lakes, and that's not my first time there. I've been there a couple different times because I lost one of my partners some years ago, and those are tragic things. I think Bergeron, this weekend, they put together a memorial. So anytime we can give the families of these folks a little better idea as to where we as a society can at least help them understand the tragedies that do happen is certainly a step in the right direction, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator Gretzen. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if one of the witnesses can help us understand how the question of causal connection is dealt with in here, because it seems to me at some point, even if a person starts a fleeing in a motor vehicle and they abandon the motor vehicle aspect of the chase, then there's some concomitant responsibility on that of the law enforcement officers that are giving chase in vehicles to adjust their conduct to reflect the change in circumstances as well. I'm not real familiar with the details of the case that led to this bill, but if you've got a police officer that's responding in a squad car with siren and lights and wants to get there as quickly as possible, if it had not started out as a motor vehicle fleeing case, that police officer would have been the one responsible for any injuries that occurred to pedestrians, for example, if they were hit, or another police officer that was hit. And so then the question of, it's not quite a use of force analogy, but sort of use of means, I guess, speeding at 80 miles per hour in a squad car, is that the appropriate use of getting to a scene quickly or chasing down a person who's on foot? And how does that fit in with the causation as it would relate to this bill?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Latz, thank you for the question. That causation issue exists now. I mean, the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the fleeing caused the injuries that occur. And that's true now. Even if they don't bail out of the car, if the police are chasing, in your scenario, you know, if you would argue that chase was not reasonable, the state wouldn't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was a substantial causal factor under the case law. And that doesn't change as a result of this bill. The state will still have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the actions of the person, once they've bailed out of the car, are still the cause of the injuries that occur. And obviously, as you get further away from that scene, if there's a break in that chase where we can't prove that the person is actually fleeing, we're not going to be able to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think the key protection here with regard to causation is our burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the actions of the person fleeing were the cause of the injury.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I thank you for that description. You know, while we all certainly have sympathy for those who lose their lives in this process or in these kinds of situations, I think we on the committee always have some responsibility to legislate based less on emotion and more on analysis of the law and the way it would operate. And so if someone flees in a motor vehicle for a block and says, boy, that was stupid, gets out of their car and decides they're going to try to run, you know, at what point does it become the police responsibility to stop chasing in a motor vehicle and putting others at risk from that act? And, you know, maybe this saving part of this is that causation. I do worry about how that would actually play out in a trial. The concern that it would carry over, the causation would kind of automatically carry through the fleeing on foot part without it being too carefully analyzed. But I guess that would be the responsibility of counsel representing the defendant in that situation to try to draw those lines appropriately and leave the burden of proof as it will fall. But thanks for the explanation. I think that's helpful.
Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, in my experience, and I wasn't part of the system that led up to the prosecutorial decision, and we had to make our case on causation. And typically, two factors seem to have been weighed, at least in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, when we would bring those forward, proximity and time. If there was too much of a gap physically between where the police were and where the behavior occurred, and oftentimes the Ramsey County Attorney would say that you could not show the causation because the distance between the two were such that you did not have a clear causal link. And the other example of that would be time, where we started to chase at a certain time, and then 20 minutes later, after we'd lost sight of the car then drives and hits somebody. 20 minutes after we've shut our pursuit down, they would make the argument in terms of not choosing to prosecute that we couldn't make our causal case that we were still in pursuit 20 minutes after this if we'd already shut down the chase. So proximity in terms of distance and time were the two factors that, in my experience, prosecuting attorneys used in making the determination as to whether they would prosecute based on the causation. And I can't say what judges and others in the system beyond that used in terms of their determination, but I would argue that at least is a minimum set of causal factors that should be considered and were considered at the prosecutorial level.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Harrington, first off, my or our condolences to Mr. Bedard for the loss of your brother, your family, and to the Minneapolis Park Board Police. That's got to be a very hard thing. My question is this. What is the penalty difference? It sounds like it's a felony if you're driving a vehicle. What is the penalty difference if you're just fleeing an officer on foot? And why isn't that a felony?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, the penalty for fleeing on foot is a misdemeanor. I will tell you that in the original incarnation of this bill several years ago, that was included. And we got feedback from a number of people here who felt that that was too broad, that you could have a kid running out of a store. The example we got was kid running out of the store, the police go to chase, officer gets hit. Do we really want to make that now the equivalent of that? And so our purpose in amending the language to what you see here was to really focus on those highly dangerous situations that begin as a fleeing in a motor vehicle and recognizing that by people bailing out or by initiating it in a car, they were endangering not only the people in front of that car, but the police response that came behind it. And so although when we started out it was perhaps broader and would have penalized more, what you see here is as a result of a lot of discussion, a much more narrow bill, and we really wanted to focus on the dangerousness here, and we did think about those issues.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, my questions were kind of similar to Senator Hall's one, and I kind of wondered, because in the end, again, I didn't hear all the details of how it happened, but it does strike me that if somebody's never in the motor vehicle and they're fleeing on foot and police officer goes chasing him and hits somebody, would you be able to prosecute that? I suppose it depends on the circumstances. He asked the question I wanted to know and what it was for somebody who was just in that situation. And these are always tragic things. I have a feeling it goes up to the prosecution and defense. I mean, can you show that it was the fact that they were fleeing? I presume it's the fact that you're requiring the motor vehicle to have been involved at one point. I still think you'd have a lot of trouble. I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I picture you have a real trouble prosecuting this if somebody leaves their vehicle and flees on foot. But I guess that's the issue. I was just curious what it was. And
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Brown,
if I could just respond briefly, Senator Marty. I think what you see here is a recognition that although sometimes there are foot chases that might merit a response in a motor vehicle, those are very rare. Ordinarily, if there's a foot chase, if it begins as a foot chase, the officers are on foot as well. It's rare that you have them a chase begin as a fleeing an officer where the officers are in their vehicles. I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but the recognition here is that where the chase begins in a motor vehicle, where the fleeing behavior by the offender begins in a motor vehicle, that's a particularly dangerous event, and that's what this bill is really getting at.
Senator Martin.
And Mr. Chair, I apologize for not being here for the explanation of the story, but was this seconds after the guy jumped out of the vehicle that the accident occurred, or was this like 10 minutes later running around and chasing him down?
This was within moments of them getting out, but the minute they got out of the vehicle, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, the moment they got out of the vehicle, they were no longer fleeing in a motor vehicle.
Right, I hear you.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brown, I'm going to give you another hypothetical, and I should know the answer to this, but I'll ask you. The term of foot patrol, walking along, and the officer sees somebody come out of the liquor store, may have heard a shot, come out of the liquor store with a gun and starts off on foot. That officer is now in foot pursuit, identifying himself. Maybe even a shot goes off to try and scare him off. That officer were to run two blocks, still in pursuit, were then to get hit by a car. Would this cover that? Wouldn't, would it?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Brown.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, no. No, it would not. And I think, as I said before, it's an interesting process, and this obviously isn't our first year here. Sergeant Dineen and Mr. Bedard have been working on this for quite some time with our office, and that really was a compromise in terms of making sure that it was focused on the most dangerous behavior. There are those incidents where that can happen, and this bill wouldn't cover it, unfortunately, but it represents, we think, the most dangerous cases. And thank you.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Just to follow up to that point, and my scenario, Mr. Brown, was we now have a felon that's running. If this is a misdemeanor that actually runs in foot and the officer gets then killed in the line of duty, it turns into a different situation. So it's different. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Goodwin.
One more. I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Mr. Chair, David Brown.
Okay, Mr. Chair, David Brown. You're saying that it's the most dangerous. Are you saying that? And I haven't looked at this area statute to see what it is. But are you saying this is under circumstances where the person is a felon that's being chased, or that there's certain types of reasons that would, certain types of crimes that he supposedly committed, he or she supposedly committed, and they were being chased, or is it just anyone that an officer is chasing for any reason, and they flee and somebody gets hurt? What's the criteria?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin. Anytime you choose to flee an officer in a motor vehicle, it's a felony. And what we were trying to say is that when you flee in a motor vehicle, that's different. That's more dangerous than if you just take off running on foot. That is, when you take a vehicle and start moving that at high speed, you are not only endangering the people in front of that vehicle, but when the officers respond to that fleeing, that becomes a particularly dangerous situation. So that was the point of that comment. Anytime you flee in a motor vehicle, it's a felony.
Senator Goodwin.
And I agree with this bill. I don't have a problem with that. But I really do think we need to take a look at situations where police chases do happen, particularly through residential areas. I have a little bit of a problem with every police department having their own rules around that. Because there have been a lot of people hit and killed and during police chases. And I don't know, maybe they're chasing somebody that's done some awful things and it could be worse. But I don't always get that out of the people that are being chased. I just wish we had some some more rules around when a chase is, some more state laws around when a chase is okay and when it isn't. And I know that would be really hard to define, but I also think there's got to be a lot more consideration for chasing through neighborhoods and chasing through areas where there can be an accident caused. And I certainly understand, and I have family members in the police department, and I certainly understand how you can get excited and get upset and somebody's running from you. But there's a lot of emotion involved in that too. And I just it's just a little hard to believe that every police station has its own rules around that, and that we would leave that possible danger open for innocent bystanders or whatever, and chase regardless of the potential consequences.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you to Senator Goodwin's comments. I don't always presume that people at a higher level of government will make a better decision, first off. Secondly, the dangers that Senator Harrington, when he was Chief Harrington, faced in St. Paul are dramatically different than police situations in War Road or Brainerd or Lakeville, where I live. These ladies and gentlemen are trained to understand how to balance issues of public safety. I am fully comfortable with the fact that people who have training in those areas, beyond what I will ever read about, are perfectly capable to know when the gravity of the situation and the danger that this criminal or potential criminal poses to society sufficiently puts the public at risk to justify a chase. And since I've never strapped a gun on and put my life at risk, like Senator Harrington, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and others, I think they should be the ones to make that decision, not us.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, I believe, Senator Harrington, this bill would move from here to the floor. Would that be correct?
That would be my desire, sir.
Members, any thoughts as to whether this matter should move to the consent calendar or to general orders?
I'd say general orders.
All right. There's been an indication that it would be appropriate to go to general orders. So your motion then, Senator Harrington, would be to move to pass the bill with the recommendation to move to the floor?
That is correct.
All right. Senator Harrington so moves. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion does pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have on the calendar is Senate File 1214, which is Senator Limmer's bill. Welcome, Senator Limmer.
Thank
to
you.
Your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1214 is a bill relating to data practices as well as a safe at home program. And here to explain the bill is Ms. Hugdahl.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm just going to adjust the microphone here. I'm Melinda Hugdahl from the Legal Services Advocacy Project. Senate File 1214 is really a clarification bill, an important clarification, but essentially a clarification. Just so folks are aware, it has bipartisan support, and as far as I'm aware, no opposition, so I'm not aware of any other testifiers in this bill. What the bill does is clarifies when the court can issue a protective order to prevent disclosure of an address of a victim of domestic abuse who's entered the Safe at Home program when the person who's in the program becomes involved in a legal proceeding. The Safe at Home program, which is Chapter 5B, was enacted in 2006 to provide another level of protection for victims of domestic violence. Senator Limmer was the chief author of that piece of legislation in 2006, and Senator Jungbauer was the co-author, actually, of that piece of legislation. The program has an address protection program so that the victim's actual address is protected from public disclosure, and they get an alternate address, and then all of their mail is processed through the Secretary of State's office. So that's what the program essentially is. The key to providing safety for these folks is protecting the address, and once the location is discovered, there's really no point to them being in the program any longer. What gave rise really to this bill was a person who came to us who was involved in a legal proceeding and who also was involved in the Safe at Home program. There may be questions asked in the course of a legal proceeding that would disclose the person's address. Typically, those are what we call foundation questions, and they may disclose where the person is. The provision in the bill clarifies the court can, again, it's permissive, issue a protective order to protect that information to prevent disclosure of the address. A protective order, by the way, for those who are not familiar with what that is not a separate legal proceeding in and of itself. It's an order that the court issues within a legal proceeding to typically seal certain information from being publicly available. So that's what we're talking about as a protective order. The bill is limited. It only protects information that leads to the victim's location, not the entire testimony of a victim who might be testifying case or any other piece of court information that references a person in the program. So it's a very limited tool in the toolbox for the courts. Courts can and do issue protective orders now. The reason we're bringing this as legislation is because the case that we had, the court expressed to us the opinion that because this is a creature of statute and the protections for people in the program are statutory, they were uncomfortable with extending it their inherent authority to the protective order and would prefer that the legislature clarify that, in fact, they could do that. So it was kind of a crossover between the province of the legislature and the courts. So that's the reason for the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions, if there are any, about the bill.
Is anyone who wants to appear in testimony in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, do any members of the committee have any questions they'd like to address? Seeing none, Senator Limmer, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1214 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Senator Limmer has moved that File 1214 be recommended to pass and move to the floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion passes. Congratulations, Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, we've reserved the balance of the afternoon and the evening for Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill next.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, welcome to the committee.
I don't think he heard that.
Mr. Chair. Can we get out of here by 10:30?
Marty?
I think we can get out of here by 10:30.
If you don't ask any questions, Senator Marty, we will.
I never do.
Mr. Chair, if we can hold all questions until the 24th of May. We would appreciate that.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
To your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you is Senate File 943, the Game and Fish Second Engrossment Bill. And before starting, if I could offer the A9 amendment, it's a pretty straightforward, includes basically some definitions. If that would be appropriate this time, I would certainly do that. If you need some description on that, I have members here from the DNR to describe that for you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A9 amendment in order to put his bill in the order in which he wishes to have it. It's not an author's amendment. Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's been explained to me it's not an author's amendment. Why don't you explain the amendment then?
I'll probably defer that to who wants to go here first.
Mr. Chairman, if it's technical, I think we can sort of treat it as an
okay.
amendment.
I can certainly do it myself if it's really technical, but I'll have
you. If it is a technical amendment, thank you, Senator Marty. We will simply proceed with a vote on the technical amendment. All those in favor of the A9 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Engelbrechtson, two-year bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could just go over a couple parts of it here pertaining to the judiciary issues of the bill. It contains various game and fish law changes following the following are Section 23 provides that the owner of a dog that mortally wounds a big game animal is subject to civil penalties under the owner of a dog that kills a big game animal. Section 24 makes it a gross misdemeanor to take big game during the time a person is prohibited from obtaining a license to take a big game. Section 32 specifies that a person who possesses unlawful fish from Canada may be charged in the same manner if the fish were unlawful in Minnesota. Section 34 makes a parent or guardian liable for allowing a minor child to hunt without a required license, permit, training, and certification, or in violation of game fish laws. Section 36 provides that a person with a valid muzzleloader license may only have a muzzleloader and handgun, any handgun in possession. Section 40 allows a person to permit, with a permit to carry a handgun, to have a handgun in possession while hunting deer by archery. Section 44 prohibits the shooting of grouse near a motorized vehicle unless the person is at least 10 feet from the vehicle. This prohibition would not apply to a person with a disability permit to shoot from a stationary motor vehicle. And Section 56 amends the law providing certain liability protections for owners of land that is used for recreational purposes to include an owner of land leased to the state or subject to an agreement or contract for purposes of the state-sponsored walk-in access program. That, Mr. Chair and members, is the general issues of why we're here before you. If you have any other questions of the bill, we have Mr. Rodman from the DNR enforcement here, as well as Mr. Don Carlos for questions, if you have any.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 34 makes a parent or guardian liable for allowing a minor. I assume the key word there is allowing, because if a minor were to go out and do it without the parent or guardian understanding that they were doing it, they then wouldn't be liable.
That's correct.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Okay.
Unless it was you, Senator Michelle, and you said that they didn't have permission to do that. But that would be accurate.
I understand.
Yes.
Senator Hall.
The other question I have, thank you, Mr. Chair, is Section 44. Where did you come up with the 10-foot from the vehicle in shooting a grouse? I road hunt, and Senator Engelbrechtson?
Took his name down.
I road hunt, and
I understand.
We get out, you know, take the guns out of the trunk, and the grouse is back there, and, we may not be but 30 feet from the grouse. You know how grouse are. They're still standing there, and we take a shot. So there's probably a good reason. I was just wondering what it is.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I'm going to take a stab at that. I think it's a fair chase thing is what it is, Senator. And I can't tell you how many rough grouse I've shot myself. And the rough grouse, as you know, it can be very smart, can also be very foolish. A rough grouse sometimes will, if you remember, and I'm sure you do, you'll remember them, they will actually try and hide in the middle of the road. And they're very vulnerable. And I think that's where this comes from. That's the years of being able to, I guess you wouldn't call it pot shot them, but nevertheless, they were quite vulnerable. And I think this has been kind of a work in progress, and I'll let the other gentleman here talk about it. But there was even talk of even further distance than 10 feet. Actually, I think at one time we started out maybe a couple years ago was at
20 yards,
actually. So it's been talked about. But again, I think it's the fair chase. And if I can ask Don Carlos maybe to comment on that, if he has any different ideas, but that would be my feelings.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, Mike Don Carlos, Deputy Division Director in Fish and Wildlife and DNR. As Senator Engelbrechtson is correct, I'm not, I can't recite all of the history of this, but it has been a conflict between people who would like to prohibit road hunting versus, you know, people who want to continue it. And the 10 feet is, you know, a compromise that was reached, you know, amongst disparate parties. So, you know, absent the original discussion, I understand why it looks rather arbitrary, but it's a compromise distance.
Senator Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my thought, if that's the case in the chase, why not do it that the grouse has to be in flight? Is that what you're getting to?
Senator, if I...
Senator Engelbrecht.
Mr. Chair, if I could have Mr. Rodman go a little further, actually, with his description.
Major Rodman.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement. Senator Hall, there is history with this language. This was in statute about 3-4 years ago, and it was 20 yards, and there was a repealer towards the end of session that repealed this law. Last year, the DNR asked for this to come back in, and I believe in some shape or form it was in the final bill that was vetoed. We did bring this back again this year, and that distance has changed. And since it was repealed the first time, there has been a change in the law to allow for transporting an uncased firearm while you're hunting or going to or coming from hunting. And with that new provision, road hunting with no distance to be where you need to be from a grouse, the road hunting has really exploded. And we've seen a huge increase in road hunting. And one of the reasons for being 10 feet away, and at one time, the motor vehicle had to be turned off. And the reason the motor vehicle had to be turned off is because, especially an ATV or a three-wheeler, it kind of has that rhythmic pop, 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 and those grouse would just kind of nestle down and fall asleep, and the next thing they knew, they weren't there anymore. So it has been some proliferation. It's a fair chase issue. If we did have every hunter shoot a grouse that was in flight, we'd have a lot of grouse because there'd be a lot of people missing because there's a lot of people that can't hit them in flight. So it is somewhat of a fair chase issue, and it also gets into the public safety issue as well with the uncased.
Yeah, understandable. Thank you.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question about Section 23, the mortally wounding a big game animal. The difference between killing and mortally wounding, is it that it's that you can't prosecute somebody, or you can't give them the fine if you don't have the, you know, the animal is dying, but you can't prove it because you don't have it in front of you? Is that the issue? Because, I mean, there's not much difference between it other than a matter of maybe minutes. But.
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, this change we're seeking is a result of a few ALA judge rulings. Where our officers are issuing an individual, and there's been a couple of times where a dog has chased a deer, and the deer is mortally wounded, and our officer actually dispatches the animal to put it out of its misery. They're issued the civil citation for killing the big game animal, but then the administrative law judge says, well, no, you killed the animal, the dog didn't. And instead of us waiting around for the deer to die to charge him with the bigger amount, we wanted to have this provision in there so we could put that deer down.
Major Smith, Section 32 has a provision apparently regarding bringing in fish from Canada. Could you explain what that's all about? That looks odd to me.
Mr. Chair, it's illegal, and Subdivision 2, Part A says it's illegal to bring in wild animals that are unlawfully taken, bought, or possessed from another state or country. And what we have an issue with is when folks coming from Canada have an illegal limit of fish, or they're taken illegally, and they're at customs, and our officer gets called, and the Canadian wardens, who can't come into Minnesota or the U.S. because they're already across the border into our customs, and they'd like us to take care of the violation. We wanted to be able to have this pieced out so that we could put it on the bail schedule, because right now it can't be put on the bail schedule. So if we write somebody for two fish over limit, coming in from Canada, and they live in the Twin Cities or Ohio or something, it's a mandatory court appearance. So they would have to drive all the way back to I Falls to go to court over that over limit of fish. So what we're the change we're seeking would allow us then to write that criminal violation and then have it put on the bail schedule so somebody could pay a ticket, not have to drive all the way back up to International Falls.
Major Smith, it looks to me like what we're doing is enforcing a Canadian law. And I'm not seeing anything in Section 32 that talks about the bail schedule. It simply says that if it's fish that are coming in from Canada are illegal in Canada, we're going to enforce it in Minnesota. And it just strikes me being a very odd section because it appears that we would be enforcing a law that was broken in Canada. We're going to enforce it in Minnesota.
Major Smith.
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, we currently do that under current regulations. The Subdivision 2, starting on line 14.21 to 14.23, that's all existing language. We currently can charge people, and we currently do charge people that illegally take something in Canada. We also apply it to people that take or possess illegal limits or something from North Dakota or South Dakota. So this has been applied for a long time from illegal fish, in this case, coming from North Dakota, South Dakota, or the Canadian provinces. So what we're seeking for is to tease out the part from the fish coming from Canada so that we can then go to the court administration and then get this on the payables list so we could just issue the citation, not make people come all the way back to the border country to go to court.
Is there any further? Any? I didn't know I didn't have a gavel. That's one way to get me to quit asking questions, isn't it? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there further discussion of the bill? Major Smith, is there a reciprocity agreement? Do the Canadians treat similar game provisions in the same way as we do on this side of the border?
Mr. Chair, I believe so on all game and fish, yes.
Does anyone else have any further questions? Hearing none. Any further testimony? Is there any objection? Anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. All those in Senator Ingebrigtsen moves Senate File 943. It is recommended to pass, as amended, and proceed to the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, we have a lot of time left. I was just. I guess I have to. This has to go to Finance Committee, I'm told, too.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'd like to bring you to Section 36 now that you.
I'm being told that we have to go to Finance Committee.
Senator Ingebrigtsen renews his motion that Senate File 943 be recommended to pass as amended and be moved to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. No further business before the committee. The meeting is adjourned.
The DNR guy was probably a better person. Frankly, they sound awful enough that I frankly don't know what I want. I would hope whatever they are, they're kept far, far away from me. No, it's terms, his terms like
we never
that got me to voluntarily leave the environment and that resources committee. Like, I don't know anything about him. Not an outdoors person, really. My predecessor didn't do it.
Okay,
and got caught.
I love how she takes the most important thing.
Come on, dude.
Art, did you get a haircut? Did you get a haircut?
Yes.
It's very nice. Cross our fingers.
I know what the subject was.
Take that last to August.
The eggs.
I think we should go to all
the small stuff, but it's just a type of thing. There you have it.
A little can of worms thing is going on there.
Yeah, you get it in. It shouldn't take long. It took half time.
Happy Bonnie is. I haven't already said hi to you.
We had talked about
I'm just talking about that.
I don't know what exactly.
To see if one